Hello, I'm Paola, and welcome to A Contemplative Revolution, a podcast by the WCCM, about what it means to live a contemplative, spiritual, and Christian life while still playing an active role in our modern world. Join us for conversations with fellow contemplatives in action from around the globe. In this talk, Lawrence Freeman explores the idea of distraction as a way of understanding what in the religious vocabulary calls sin. Distraction is a good way of understanding sin, not simply as a temptation, but to understand it as a disturbance of the mind of a natural state of health. This is part of the Monte Oliveto Retreat 2014. We hope you enjoyed the podcast.
So, yesterday we ended by talking about distraction as a way of understanding what in the religious vocabulary we call sin or original sin. And it's a good way of understanding sin, not simply as a temptation or a legal infraction, but to understand it as a disturbance of the mind, a disturbance of our natural state of health. And a distraction or distraction, distractedness can become chronic, like any illness can become chronic. To some degree, it's inevitable. We live with it. But we can also reduce it and reduce the distortion of reality that it can create. The first step, of course, is to become aware that we are distracted. That's a big step. And the reason we take that... that's what he warned me against. To take that step is usually the result of discovering the side effects and the unpleasant effects of distractedness. You might as well see if they're... I don't know how far away he's working. Yeah. Okay, so you could even say then, in a sense, if you want to play with language a bit, that distraction is a form of mental illness. And if you look at it like that, then attention, which is the opposite of distraction, becomes a healing process. It's a way of healing that condition of distraction. And we can make sense of that idea because we all... recognize that when we receive good attention, selfless attention, we're not talking about the attention that you receive from a salesman, you know, they can be very attentive, can't they? Make you feel you're the most important person in the world. But if you've got any common sense, you realize that it's not a very deep or pure or selfless kind of attention. They want something from you. So the attention that makes a difference to us, that makes us feel healthier and happier and better, is essentially a selfless attention. It's when somebody turns their attention and therefore their self, because where your heart is, there your treasure is, Jesus said. So where your attention is, that's where you are. That's where you are. And that's why attention, in this sense, is the heart of all relationships. Whether it's a 30-year-old marriage or, your first date. It depends where your attention is, where your attention really is, and how that attention can be sustained and grow. So attention, we could say, is health. It's certainly health-giving. And it's an essential part of the healing process itself. When we look at the divine aspect of attention, the highest source of attention, then we might even say that attention is love. Attention is the healing process. We begin, in other words, to feel better and as soon as we receive attention, and I got attention from an unwanted source here. And of course, we also feel better when we give attention, because there is a relief and a release of ourselves when we do give attention to something that we really value. I mean, that's why we like music or art or sport or whatever we enjoy giving our attention to, not because it's good for us or because we make money out of it or because it makes us look good in the eyes of other people. But when we give our attention in that genuine way, selflessly and honestly, we feel better. And that no doubt explains something about meditation too. Meditation is this work of attention, and it's a choice, it's a work to give your attention. It's not passive, it's a giving. But in the giving, we also begin to experience that we are receiving. But it has to begin with the giving. And then very quickly, the work of attention becomes something so beneficial, so delightful, that, we don't exactly become addicted to it because it sets us free, but it certainly becomes a part of our life that we don't want to lose. I think this explains maybe why children take to meditation so simply and immediately. It always amazes me how a group of children in a class will just do what you say. You know, they will start saying the mantra. You just have to be clear about it, and they have to be present. And then very quickly, they discover this firsthand. They discover it immediately without any need for talks like this. In fact, talks like this would only put them off. So they just get it experientially, and they like it. And that's why the kids say that they meditate at other times without any obligation or compulsion, that they will ask their teachers for meditation time. If the teacher forgets, when they move to the next year, they expect and hope to find meditation there. So I think the reason for that is that it's just the most basic and most simple truth of consciousness, really, that attention makes us feel better and makes everyone feel better. The kids themselves will say amazing things sometimes, like one child said in a class, I noticed that if you ask people to do something before meditation, they often say no. But after meditation, they'll say yes. And one little girl was saying, because, you know, if you think back to your hours in the playground in recess, these were very intense times. We call them play, and teachers go off and have a coffee and put their feet up, but for the children, this may be the most emotionally intense part of their day, so they come back emotionally exhausted by it. And that's why they like to meditate after recess. You think they'd all be agitated and sweaty, but they instinctively know that that's the time that they need to get back to balance and get back to the center that they that they enjoy being in. And then they'll say, you know, if I've had a fight with someone, and you would, this little girl said to me, and we wouldn't say sorry to each other, but when we meditated, we said sorry. I mean, these are such profoundly simple expressions of experiences you'd like to see, you know, taking place at the UN or the World Bank or whatever. So in this process, though, one of the first things we discover is our, what we call, failure. If we don't acknowledge and accept our failure, then we give up. Because nobody likes to accept some football teams. Nobody likes to keep on losing. So our discovery of our distractedness, when we start to try to pay attention, to say the mantra, feels like failure, but it's not failure. It's just the first part of the recovery or the healing process. So we have to pinpoint this feeling of failure, discouragement, and it may trigger memories of other failures or disappointments or sense of inadequacy, just in the same way that losing your car keys might give you an overwhelming feeling of panic and distress, because it triggers memories of other losses that you've had in your life. So in the same way, the feeling of failure can be deeply uncomfortable and disturbing. So you have to identify it and you have to lay it aside in the same way that you leave all the other ideas or thoughts behind to one side as well. And this is really a kind of maturing process. This is where we actually begin to grow up. We do the best we can, but we must do no less than the best. That's the approach we need to take. Confucius said, the glory of the human being is not in never falling down, but it is in getting up repeatedly. It's a very gospel idea, that the prodigal son coming home again and again. So maturity is really applying the best that we are capable of in one area of our life to all areas of our life. This is why meditation becomes part of your life. Now, if you were a gold medal athlete or an award-winning famous musician who does their best on stage or on the track and gets applauded, as a human being, that performer should, you know, maybe very, very unbalanced. As many artists find that they are, because of the great talent they have, that in which they will do their best, but this doesn't translate into doing their best at home, or doing their best in their relationships, or with their colleagues at work. Now, in meditation, we commit ourselves to, and we begin to experience a growth, a development, a change within ourselves that is felt in every aspect of our life and all our relationships. Simply because you're doing your best at this central point, the simplest and deepest part of yourself, to pay attention, that's all, just to be present, just to pay attention, and you do your best in this work. In other words, you keep returning to the work of the mantra, you lay aside the feeling of failure or inadequacy, or when you feel overwhelmed by your distractions. You simply do your best, and that has a ripple effect from the center outwards, and it will begin to manifest itself and show itself, this quality of attention, in everything you do. I don't think I told you about the other student at the MBA course who said within a week or two of meditating regularly, quite soon, within a week, I think, he said, I knew something was happening because he said, when I walked from my home to the school along a road that I've walked for the last 2 years, he said, for the first time in 2 years, I've become aware of this road. He said, it's a really interesting road. He said, some really nice houses and, I don't know, nice trees and whatever it was that he found interesting. And he said, it amazes me. Where have I been for the last 2 years as I walked along this road? I've been in my head thinking about my papers or my problems. And he said, it can only be because I started to meditate. So in meditation then, we need to approach it with full recognition of our imperfection and get rid of this virus of perfectionism, but at the same time, we do no less than our best. And that's the approach that leads to growth and into a fuller wholeness as a person. If a person can be defined as someone who can pay attention, then your growth as a person, your personal growth, is the development or expansion of this capacity to pay attention. As I mentioned yesterday, you may not be the first person to see it, although you'll sense that it's happening, but somebody else you work with or live with, or your children or your spouse or your fiancé will say, you're changing. This experience of meditation changes our idealized and unrealistic fantasy about health and immortality and restores a connection with wholeness. We begin, in other words, to experience what health really means and what wholeness feels like. This experience of meditation is all about relationship, because all experiences of relationship point towards the same truth. Meditation is about relationship. This is not how it is often packaged or presented in the media. In a highly hyper-individualistic culture like ours, where health is seen to be a very individualistic thing, my health, we look at cures or remedies in a very individualistic way. And this approach of medicine, which would almost mean that you don't need to see the person that you're treating, you just read their reports, their tests, and you may even say, I can make a better judgment about this person and their treatment if I don't meet them and don't hear about their family, because that's only going to cloud my judgment. I mean, that I don't think that's entirely unknown. So this hyper-individualistic sense of self that's developed because of our reductionism, or our excessive reductionism, as I said, reductionism isn't a bad thing, gave us penicillin, for example. This hyper-individualistic sense of self means that we look not only at medicine, but at meditation in this very self-centered way. What's this going to do for me? Well, that may be where you start, and that's you start where you are. But it's also why it is so important that the way the meditation is taught. In what direction is it pushing you? Is it towards a deeper and more inflated self centeredness, which will eventually blow up in your face, of course, or is it the beginning of a training in attention turning 180 degrees, whatever it is, that attention becomes comprehensive rather than just self-centered. In other words, about relationship. And one of the very first areas in which we experience the changes of meditation in our life is in our relationships. And beginning, as I was saying at the beginning, in our relationship with ourselves. This helps us when we come back to the idea of health, to see that human life is not a medical condition. It's a human life. It's not just, and the pain or the suffering involved in human life is not without meaning. Pain and suffering are not desirable unless there's a quite serious disturbance in the psyche. But for a reasonably healthy mind, we don't seek to find or to be the cause of suffering or pain to others. And we do what we can to relieve this pain and suffering in ourselves and others. But they're not entirely meaningless. We learn on the road to wholeness the art of carrying our cross. And who doesn't have one? And we learn the art of suffering. And one of the great areas of wisdom in traditional cultures in the past, the art of dying. Only a healthy and whole person can really do this. As our idea of health changes, so does the meaning of success. In other words, if we can accept our failure to be perfect meditators, this will begin to translate into a new understanding of what health and wholeness means and of the place of healing in our lives. We'll see that it's not about perfectionism, but fidelity. Your faith has healed you, Jesus said to Bartimaeus. It's not about doing better than the next person, seeing life in terms of continuous competition and the struggle for survival and supremacy, but it's about how to be with others on the journey in a relationship of mutual support and encouragement. And one of the great signs of that simple truth, children get that too, because children can see that when they meditate together, there's less bullying in the classroom. I mean, this could be, you know, and would no doubt be, as teachers and principals would say, a direct and effective way of addressing some of the really serious problems that infect education and children today at a young age. The bullying syndrome, the digital bullying, the homophobia. And the experience of children is quite simply that they get on better with each other and they're happier. So meditation creates community, as we know. Health, like life, is best understood as a gift. rather than as a product that we fabricate, or certainly not one that we buy. And at the root of all of this, again, we come back to this quality of awareness. The Cincinnati Children's Hospital in the States is known to be the safest hospital in the world. And I met the doctor, a doctor from there who is the world expert on safety in hospitals. And she confirmed for me a piece of information I'd heard, that if doctors wash their hands regularly, then infection will be reduced by 50%. But she also was able to end the Friday afternoon mortality rate. You know, even the best surgeons probably start yawning on a Friday afternoon. So by good rotor systems and good management, she's been able to create a hospital has become a place of safety. Quite important when you think that in the US there's at least 100,000 and maybe much more deaths due to medical error every year. What she has also come to be aware of, she said, is the importance of awareness itself. That you can put in the best procedures, you can train people to do necessary safety measures, but at the end of the day, what really makes the difference is the awareness of the nurse or the doctor or the technician in that moment. Just being aware of what they're doing. We were talking yesterday about the absence of eye contact in some of those relationships. And clearly, if you're not aware of the person, what the person in front of you that you're talking to looks like, you're probably not going to have that quality of awareness when you come to the decisions that you have to make. If you're feeling tired, emotionally empty, then that is not a good state for a healer to be in. The first responsibility then for any of us is to heal ourselves. Physician, heal thyself, as Shakespeare said. Or work out your own salvation with diligence, as St. Paul says. Or as they say on planes with the safety instructions, if you start, you know, if the gas, not gas masks, but the oxygen masks come down, put it on yourself first before you put it on the child or needy person next to you. This might sound egotistical to somebody who wants to be a martyr, but it's not. It's a love of self. It's the recognition of what is increasingly, I think, common now in medical policy, national medical policy, the idea of self-regulation. In other words, health isn't just a product that you give to a sick person who comes to you, but it's something that the sick person is partly responsible for themselves. So as one doctor friend of mine said, you know, if you have a very obese person who's smoking, drinking, does no exercise, and they come to see you and they say, "Doctor, I'm not feeling very well. Can you give me something?" What do you do? So I give him pills which I know will do no good at all? Or do you try to, you know, say, "Well, you've got to look after yourself. Got to start regulating your own health." So, and the fact that this is a responsibility is very obvious when we look at this in the terms of meditation. No one can force you to meditate. In fact, no one can persuade you to meditate. There's no argument in the end that's going to make you decide to meditate. Of course, you need to hear about it. You need to hear about it in a good way. And you need some support. We all do. We all need that. But at the end of the day, it's going to be your choice to begin. That's what Father John says, is all you have to do is to begin. As soon as you begin, like those children, you begin to experience the healing that it opens up for you. And this relationship with self begins to change as soon as we accept that responsibility to look after yourself. We say to everybody, take care. But that's what it really means. And this then determines our way of relating and our quality of service that we give to others. So martyrs don't really come into this picture at all. Martyrs are okay in the Colosseum, but not at home. You don't want to be living with a martyr or in the workplace. Somebody who is driving themselves to an early death or into the ground or in a state of continuous burnout on a hospital team, or a mother who is, or a father who is in this constant state of I don't know, burnout. They make everybody miserable. They make many people feel guilty and angry. So our first responsibility, if we want to be in relationship and if we want that relationship to be a healthy one and a healing one and a caring one for the people we are in relationship with, our first responsibility to others is to be as healthy and as happy as we can be ourselves. And that involves not being too hard on ourselves when we fail. In other words, incorporate the sense of failure into our practice and learn from failure, as we say. Okay, let's learn from a little variety as we go out into the sun-drenched courtyard, which is going to get hotter and hotter over the next few days. So, the practice of meditation begins to change our understanding of what we mean by health, because it gives us a deepening experience of wholeness. And we begin to realize that health, and like attention or awareness, is something completely natural. It's the default to which we keep returning. But however fit or metabolically efficient your body may be, you're not really healthy if you are unable to be aware, if you are self-fixated and unaware of those around you. You can hardly call that a state of health, of being healthy or being whole. I was standing on the other side of the road recently across the way from the supermarket, and I watched this woman come out carrying several overloaded bags. And as she came out, an item fell out of one of the bags onto the ground. And of course, she was in a dilemma. What should she do? because she couldn't lean down to pick it up because she was carrying these other bags. So then, if you can remember, imagine what we would all feel like in the situation, you start to process certain options. One would be to put all the bags down and pick up your bar of soap and put it back in. But then you have to, it's quite difficult then to pick up all these bags again from the ground. So you could imagine all of this was going through her mind. So she was just standing there for a few seconds, wondering about what to do. And then of course, somebody came up and picked up the item for her and put it into the bag for her, which in other circumstances would have been a bit intrusive. But because somebody is in need, you allow them in a little bit more into your private space. It was a gesture of kindness. Could easily have been intrusive and presumptuous, but because she was in need, it was, and it was received as a small act of kindness. Now, the person who did that then, like any good Samaritan should, just disappeared. And it was clear that he wasn't doing this for any self-interest. And just smiled and walked on, and she said, thank you. And it was all over and done with. Now, you could imagine different ways of encountering that incident. You could, for example, have been standing there, watching her come out, lost in your own thoughts, and you see this little incident, this discomfort that she was facing, and you just look at it, and you wonder what she's going to do. Or you might even take out your camera and take a picture of it. And it's surprising, actually, that there's a high percentage of the population who would do just that. They would just look. They would be aware, but that would be as far as it went. Some people would not be aware of it at all, wouldn't even notice it. But others would observe it with a kind of observational awareness, but without response, without that spontaneous, natural, kind response of the person who didn't think about what they were doing. They just instinctively, intuitively, and spontaneously came forward, saw the problem, picked it up, and put it in the bag for her. So you might be completely unaware of what's going on around you, just totally blind to people's needs, or you might observe those needs but without any sense of attention. It's when awareness becomes attention, and attention is always personal because it's your gift of self, remember. So it's really when you move from just sort of animal awareness to human attention that we begin to see the place of compassion and the source of compassion. So compassion arises out of this awareness, but it is, and it's natural. You don't have to be a saint to feel concern for somebody suffering, but it's attention, personal attention, which then translates that into action and into, therefore, real relationship. So our faculty of attention has to be developed, and I think that's what parents and teachers try to do for children, is to not only get them through exams or to learn certain basic skills, but also to think of the needs of others, to be polite, to be courteous, and to learn to pay attention, not just to be aware, but to pay attention. First of all, though, of course, you need to have enough spare memory in order to be able to see it. If you're hyper-distracted and rushing and your mind is racing, then you may not even notice it at all. Even first level of awareness is missing entirely. And if you don't have the first level of awareness, it can't develop into attention, and it won't be focused in compassion. The root of awareness then taps into the spirit, into the spring of compassion. It brings care and attention together. That's what the prefix med means, if you remember. Meditation, medicine, it means care and attention, which is the skill set of any healer and of all healing relationships. They say that meditators have thicker brains, or regular meditators have thicker brains than other people, and more active frontal lobes. And these tests, brain research on meditators, shows a decrease in the activity in those parts of the brain that deal or forms the sense of space and time. And that makes sense. It's one of the reasons you perhaps feel less stressed after you meditate, because time is less of a pressure, and you also feel more empathy. You feel closer to other people rather than separated or alienated from them. And perhaps this illustrates, it doesn't explain, but it illustrates, perhaps, why meditation leads to a deeper sense of unity, which is our feeling of wholeness shared with another person. Because it certainly makes us feel better to feel whole, and that our fragmented and distracted and anxious self recovers peace and harmony and a sense of togetherness and integration. And we feel we're together. I got myself together, we say. That feeling of being drawn into a unity or wholeness. But when we and that's certainly beneficial, and it's certainly a better way of living. But as soon as we do begin to experience our own wholeness, Father John usually uses the word harmony, as soon as we begin to experience this wholeness, we then, of course, discover, amazingly, we can share this feeling of personal wholeness with others. And this is why it's in our relationships that we begin to really develop. Anyway, all of this interest in the neurology and the science of meditation is quite new. The first recorded research into meditation was only 1931. And since then, there's been this cascade, of course, of medical and scientific research. And somebody involved in it said to me once, it's the only field of research medically that hasn't yet come up with any negative side effects. And this reductionistic approach to meditation, it's inevitable and probably very useful, interesting, that we should apply this scientific method, this reductionistic approach to meditation. And it offers us interesting information, which serves perhaps to make us be aware of how wonderful we are. What an amazing thing, or as Hamlet says, was it Hamlet? What a piece of work is man? That sense of wonder that grows within us along with the feeling of wholeness. It's in the state of disconnection and of fragmentation that we lose this sense of wonder or mystery. We become simply a mass of loose wires or a mass of problems, a knot that we can't untie. But with the experience of wonder, and that would lead to all sorts of, could lead to all sorts of self-destructive behavior. But with the sense of wholeness, we begin to recover that childlike state of wonder. Unless you become like a little child, Jesus said, we cannot enter into the fullness of health, into the kingdom of God. So all of this scientific research doesn't explain, but it illustrates. And in illustrating what is happening, it can awaken within us. And for the modern mind, we like to have the sort of seal of approval of science. It makes things respectable. But if we remain at this reductionistic level, we get stuck. Doctors were once called a learned profession because they interpreted facts and they looked for meaning in and patterns in the evidence that of their senses. But if doctors get stuck at this reductionistic level, then the body loses its mystery, its wonder, and its capacity for surprising us, for its own self-healing, for its capacity for therapeutic relationships, and it just becomes, the body just becomes an anatomized object. Medicine was once seen as one of the arts of human learning and wisdom, leading to philosophy in the highest sense. It was a sister subject to theology. When we split this unified approach to knowledge and wisdom, philosophy was left without a body, and the human body lost its relationship to the cosmos, its sense of being a microcosm of the cosmos. And theology, without prayer, which is always embodied, everything meaningful is embodied, theology just becomes metaphysics, and religion ends up becoming dogma. So this this disintegration of wisdom or of our different approaches to wholeness becomes a serious cultural and social problem. One consequence of this is that health is taken away from the person becomes the responsibility of the medical profession. Medicine becomes increasingly powerful. 42% of one Canadian province of their budget is spent on medicine. And you could almost say that medicine has replaced religion as the profession or the institution which is the matrix in which we live our whole life from birth to death. Life is becoming very medicalized. There are two words for life. In Greek, one is bios, which could be described as not just your biological, physical self, but the course of your life as determined by your genes or by your destiny. So that's bios. But there's another word, which is zoe. And zoe is better understood as aliveness, being alive, not just being living in a medical sense, but actually being alive with fullness of being. And this, if we could read the New Testament in the right way, this is what we would see in over and over again. This was the insight and the message that they were trying to communicate. Jesus himself said, "I have come that you may have life in all its fullness." He spoke for himself not as a judge, but as a healer. And the St. Paul, for example, speaks about the transformation of the whole person that brings us to fullness of being, the fullness of God himself. So life was seen in terms of health, not narrowly in terms of your medical condition, but in terms of the expanding aliveness of your whole self. And that, I think, is what brings us to undertake a serious practice. Healing, health-giving, and life-changing practice, such as meditation. Let's just end with one more healing miracle story. And this is the cure of the woman with a hemorrhage. This is St. Luke's. St. Luke is the patron saint of doctors and traditionally was thought to have been a physician, so he was interested in this. He said, "Now there was a woman suffering from a hemorrhage for 12 years whom no one had been able to cure. She came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak. And the hemorrhage stopped at that instant. Jesus said, 'Who touched me?' When they all denied that they had, Peter and his companions said, 'Master, is it the crowds round you pushing?' But Jesus said, 'Somebody touched me. I felt the power had gone out from me.' Seeing herself discovered, the woman came forward trembling and falling at his feet, explained in front of all the people why she had touched him and how she had been cured at that very moment. 'My daughter,' he said, 'your faith has restored you to health. Go in peace.'" So there are many elements of the story that touch on what we're exploring. The personal relationship, again, we saw it yesterday with Bartimaeus. He picked out Bartimaeus from the crowd. He heard his voice. Well, in this instant, he feels a contact, touch. And all she did was touch the fringe of his cloak. Well, touch is very important. We touch each other in different ways. We touch each other when we look at each other, eye contact. We touch each other with our words or our tone of voice. And of course, we touch with our skin. Touch is very important. Contact, relationship. She wanted to enter into a relationship with him, so she touched him. But she was frightened, so she only could only go so far in the culture she was in, so she touched the fringe of his cloak. He felt this. It says something about him, that he was able to identify this particular moment and kind of touch. The disciples said, look, everybody, you're in the middle of a crowd. People are like being on the London Underground in the rush hour. And you were to say, who touched me? And we probably call the police at that point. So, and he kept on insisting to find out who touched him. And then it says here, seeing herself discovered, she didn't want to be known. She just wanted to be cured. Just cure me, just give me a pill. But she just wanted to do it totally impersonally. It's like you're feeling hungry, but you don't want to go to have a proper meal or cook a meal or go to a restaurant even. You just go have a McDonald's. Right. So it's fast, quick cure. Nothing about, no rich, no, nothing personal in it at all. So, but he won't, as it were, let her go. He insists that the relationship be taken to the next step. And so, trembling with fear, why is she frightened? I suppose because of this hemorrhage, which made her unclean, ritually unclean. She probably shouldn't have been in the crowd at all. She certainly shouldn't have been touching a man. So, you know, think of what we, anyway, the Middle East, the worst of what we would think of as Middle Eastern attitudes towards women. And so she's terrified. Isolated, alone in her fear, and falling at his feet, she explained in front of all the people why she had touched him. She didn't just say, I touched him, but why she touched him. Because she had this 12-year-old bleeding condition. And what did that affect? A healing, not just a cure, but a healing of a person who had been isolated, alienated, and rejected, and self-rejecting for so long. And again, Jesus doesn't even do anything in this situation except just allows or perceives even the power going out from him towards this person who was coming to him in hope and in faith. He was open to the relationship that she initiated or requested. So we see again how vital relationship is to healing. And curing is only one stage of the operation, and of course, curing doesn't always work. There's one passage in which Jesus, it says, was not able to work miracles. So curing doesn't always work, just as doctors don't always know what the non-cardiac chest pain is. But the healing is a different, it's related, certainly in the human quest for health, healing and curing are related. But eventually the curing can go no further. But the healing is always possible. You can die healed. We want to die healed. And so, again, he uses the same expression, your faith has restored you to health. And health, not only seen negatively in terms of this curing of her hemorrhage, but health now quite clearly about her own sense of self, her own personal identity, transformed painfully through this openness, confession, this coming out, as it were, to the people about this shameful condition that she had, and reconnected. This is only the beginning. We don't know what happened when she went home that day or went to the to the well to draw water or whatever else she did that evening. This is only the beginning. So restoring to health and ascending back to life, to live life with this new experience of wholeness. Your faith has restored you to health. Go in peace. Come back to this understanding of peace later.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. You can subscribe to the Contemplative Revolution podcast and listen to your favorite podcast app. In the media section of the WCCM website, wccm.org, you can also find a large amount of video and audio content on meditation. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.